Welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's weekly magazine show. Today's format is a little different. We'll be hearing a single subject, the pursuit and love of mushrooms. Anna McHugh is a writer, mushroom hunter, and mycological educator. She's also pretty handy with a microphone and recorder. While pursuing her own interest in all things mycological, she interviewed a number of people who share that interest. Today we hear part one of Crazy About Mushrooms.
What do the poisoned Roman Emperor Claudius, the Aztec storm deity Quetzalcoatl, and a 5,500-year-old Iceman have in common? They were all crazy about mushrooms. I'm Anna McHugh, and I'm a mycophile. Translated into English, that means I'm crazy about mushrooms. I love cooking with them. I also love hunting for them in the woods. It's like a marvelous treasure hunt that makes tromping around in the wilderness even more fun. A couple years ago, I began growing culinary mushrooms at home, and my interest in this unique life form continued to grow. Recently, I embarked on a journey of discovery. You might not know it, but there's an entire subculture dedicated to fungus, and it's a diverse tribe indeed. There are those who hunt mushrooms for a living, scientists who spend countless hours extracting fungal DNA in order to name and classify new species. There are people who make fabric dyes out of mushrooms, artists who paint them, mystics who ingest psychedelic mushrooms to touch the infinite, and farmers who tend to huge growing rooms full of gourmet mushrooms. Mushroomers hail from all over. Bulgaria, Russia, China, Germany, Mexico, South Africa, and Canada. And you find them in every state in the Union. So I got on the road, chasing the autumn rains that bring out the mushrooms and their fans every year, to find out what I could about this enchanting world. The Tree of Life has five branches, and the fungal kingdom is one of them. There are roughly 1.5 million species of fungi, and although most people think that mushrooms and fungus are one and the same, strictly speaking, this is not true. Mushrooms are instead the biological expressions of the fungal body. It's fruit. They pop up, literally overnight in some cases, and drop spores to help the fungus reproduce. The true fungal body is called mycelium, a delicate network of cells that resides in soil, wood, and other organic material. Mycelium is literally everywhere. The network of a single fungus can also grow to tremendous size. The largest organism on Earth is a mycelial network that permeates about 2,400 acres in southern Oregon. I asked a few mushroom experts to explain fungi to me and to explain why they're so special. This is what I found out.
Picking mushrooms in the forest is just so amazing to me. Just that whole concept of gourmet food for free from the forest floor. And then you get to see where they grow, and then you get to understand the ecosystems that they're in and the impact that we put on them, and makes you want to preserve it, makes you want to save it.
Maybe half of them have names and the other half don't actually have names. Well, when you see a mushroom, it basically screams out its identity to you, and you just have to look at it and pick up on what it's saying. But, you know, most people look at a mushroom and they have no idea what it's saying. But, like, this one has a really slimy stem and it's staining black, and there's only one like that. That's Hygroscopis singeri.
For me, it's mainly the interconnectedness of fungi in the ecosystem. 90% of all vascular plants have some sort of mycorrhizal or symbiotic relationship with the fungus. Some plants cannot grow without a symbiotic relationship with the fungus. Without the fungi, we would not be here.
One of the initiatory experiences of truffles is laughter. Truffles are filled with volatile oils, and they go right up into our olfactory system and right into our brains, and they really affect our brain chemistry. They're very closely related to human pheromones. So I think that spirit of conviviality comes to life, and you know what that means in your bones and in your cells after you've had this. And that's what people call life-changing.
You know, we share a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. We exhale carbon dioxide, so do fungi. We inhale oxygen, so do fungi. And as these networks that have evolved are resilient, they're intelligent. And what I mean by that is that one side of a network can have an experience with an antagonist, with a bacterium, with a new food source, And then there was a quote-unquote memory that then is back-channeled to the network, and the network's becoming educated that if you encounter this organism again, it becomes resident within the body intellect of the mycelium. And I think one measure of intelligence is not only the ability to adapt to change, but to predict and pre-position yourself for changes in the environment. And fungi, I think, do that in a very exquisite way.
First, we have to look at the fact that a lot of the foods that we already are familiar with involve fungi. For example, yeast, baking, beer making, fermentations of all sorts, all these involve growing fungi. In addition, mushrooms are a real source of protein.
Everything has a fungus that eats it when it's gone, sucking out those nutrients so life can carry on. Every tree has a fungus.
Chefs and foodies the world over love mushrooms. Connie Green and Patrick Hamilton are mushroom gourmands, and they invited me out to Connie's home in Northern California to show me how to really cook mushrooms. Connie owns and operates Wine Forest, a gourmet mushroom company that supplies restaurants all over the world with wild-gathered mushrooms. Patrick Hamilton, the Myco-chef, volunteered to make lunch for us. Patrick is a renowned chef who prepares banquets for some of the most avid mushroom fans in the country. I arrived at Connie's home right after a terrific rainstorm, and the first thing we did was head out into the woods behind the house to find something to eat for lunch.
So, we're just going to go right up here. But here are a few. That's all we need, right? So anyway, here's chanterelles. We'll grab these.
Connie, what kind are those?
These?
What's the current name of those?
The current name is Cantharellus californicus.
You know, it's not fair to people in the world that a person who sells chanterelles as part of her living picks chanterelles 50 feet from her house. That's not right.
Or on the way to the mailbox.
Or it's very, very right. Either way, it depends on your perspective.
Oh, baby, can't you tell? I am a chanterelle.
Chanterelle.
I got the rink, rink, wrinkly goo.
What we're going to do is we're going to butter poach some of these golden chanterelles. And we're going to butter poach them in a little bit of butter, a little bit of water. We're not going to slice these mushrooms. We're going to just pull them apart. People ask me sometimes, like, what's in a mushroom? Well, they're 80 to 90% water. They have a phenomenal amount of protein compared to vegetables, a lot of vitamin B12. What we're going to do, we're going to put a little water in here. We're going to poach them and put a little butter. What's going to happen is that as it cooks, it's going to actually pull the surface water out of these chanterelles, and it's going to leave the cellular water in them, so they're going to stay kind of moist when you bite into them, but not sluggy. And chanterelles can get real sluggy. But we're going to end up, hopefully, with some nice crispy parts. So we're going to do this. We're going to get this boiling, and we're going to put these stripped in pieces, golden chanterelles in here, and we're going to put a little bit of salt in there. We start with unsalted butter, and the reason chefs like unsalted butter is we like to put our own amount of salt in it, and it's almost always fresher, the butter. So we're going to go ahead and do this. We're going to put a little salt, and Connie's got a little treat for us. We're going to use fleur de sel. We're going to use really good, the best salt. All these things are important. You know, what kind of, it's like people use fresh ground pepper. Why? Well, it tastes better. You know, good salt tastes better, good butter tastes better. You know, mushroom people, we're kind of pigs in a way.
We let the butter, salt, water, and mushrooms reduce for 15 minutes or so, and then pop some bread in the toaster. The result, butter poached chanterelles on crostini, was fabulous.
But see this, I mean, simple. You can see how difficult it was to do. We paid no attention to it whatsoever. It's not like, oh, they're done right now. It's like, okay, they're done. They're very forgiving. Once they get that gelatinized and caramelized surface to them.
They scream out for lobster.
I mean, what's not good with butter? Butter and sea salt, come on. Chef's two dirty secrets.
Herbalists have employed mushrooms for eons to resist disease and prolong life. The reishi mushroom, for instance, is a dusky red woodconk that grows on logs and stumps. The Chinese call it the thousand-year mushroom, or Ling Shi, because it's believed that those who consume it will enjoy wisdom and longevity. Now, medical science is looking to mushrooms for alternative treatments for ailments of all sorts. From curing cancer to reducing cholesterol, mushrooms offer possible solutions to some of our most challenging health problems. Christopher Hobbs, an evolutionary biologist and phylogeneticist who maps the evolutionary roots of plants at UC Berkeley, invited me to his home to talk about medicinal mushrooms. Hobbs is an herbalist, and he ran a clinical acupuncture practice for many years before deciding to go back to university and pursue a PhD. Hobbs' integration of ancestral medicine and Western science gave him a new perspective on how to make the most of nature's remedies.
I wrote Medicinal Mushrooms in the late 80s, and then again in the 1990s, I did a lot of research. I had hepatitis myself in late 60s. From traveling overseas, I got infectious hepatitis. So I tended to specialize in hepatitis in my clinical practice, and I found that shiitake extracts and turkey tails were doing my patients a lot of good. And we started producing our own medicinal mushroom extracts. And then once I got into the clinical side of things and saw their benefits firsthand, actually I saw remissions for hepatitis. And the numbers, I was monitoring viral load and monitoring liver enzymes and so forth, and I saw great improvements in the numbers, and I really got excited about the potential for medicinal mushrooms. And then, of course, I saw how they were used in Asia for centuries and centuries. So I guess that kind of played into my interest in why do mushrooms work. When we ingest them, they're interacting with a lot of immune tissue in our body. You know, we basically biosample our environment inside of our gut. If you eat wild mushrooms from the forest, to me, that's inoculating myself and protecting myself by modulating my immune system and sampling my environment and adjusting my immune response to what's out there. Nowadays, if we eat out of Safeway, that's maybe the safe way, but everything's sterilized. Everything is completely nuked. And, you know, we may be really losing out there. I think we are. If you eat out of your garden, you're getting a lot of microbes along with your salad vegetables, I can guarantee you. And you're stimulating. You're getting a lot of immunomodulation from that. And I think fungi offer that in a great measure. So you've got nutrition, you've got medicine, and they're completely safe and cheap to produce. So it's really a win-win situation there.
As our knowledge about medicinal mushrooms continues to grow, so too does our understanding of how fungus is a part of our planet's immune system. The complexity of the forest, natural meadow, and wetlands are a direct result of fungal engineering and networking. When I visited Paul Stamets, the founder of Fungi Perfecti, he explained why he began his farm and research facility.
I think it's the ultimate hubris that human species thinks that we are the only intelligent organism on this planet. Just because we don't know what these organisms do is not an excuse not to pay attention to them. And understanding how these fungal networks are able to break down rocks, break down petroleum products, break down toxins, gives us a tremendous number of tools for us to address environmental problems and environmental health issues. And so I have created this business in order to have a financial vehicle to be able to sponsor the research that I know is critically important to saving habitats and species on this planet. I mean, literally, we are walking upon the very solutions that we need so desperately today, looking skyward and looking around, saying, where are the solutions to the problems that we have? And we're walking upon them.
One of the most exciting applications of mycology in bioremediation revolves around a very human-driven problem, oil spills. And that's where oyster mushrooms might be able to help. Oyster mushrooms are an aggressive wood-decomposing mushroom that grows worldwide, and they may be able to use petroleum products as a food source. Paul Stamets invited me to go with him and his crew as they conducted research out on Puget Sound in Washington State.
The BP oil spill has really put into focus that we need novel remedies to unprecedented problems. And we are challenging all assumptions. I've been working with Battelle Laboratories for a number of years, and we've done research in using oyster mushroom mycelium and breaking down hydrocarbons, oil, petroleum products. And the fungi produce enzymes, cellulases and lignases, that break down cellulose and lignin. And they demolecularize these hydrocarbons, and we think they remanufacture them into fungal carbohydrates. But we've never tried this on water and on salt water, so we tested it. And sure enough, oyster mushroom mycelium is tolerant to salt water. And we actually sprayed oyster mushrooms, and they grew fine. So what we have here is what we call a mycoboom, and it is mycelium of oyster mushrooms on straw in a burlap sack. And the mycobooms will not only help corral oil, but as they corral it, they'll release the enzymes that will start the process of decomposition. So that's the short version. Let's see if it floats.
Yep. Ready?
Here we go. So this is the first installation in salt water of a mycoboom. Mycoboom.
This is not the first time oyster mushrooms have been used in bioremediation. Lisa Gauthier, the director of Matter of Trust, a citizen-driven bioremediation organization, told me the story of how oyster mushrooms were first employed in oil spill cleanup efforts in the San Francisco Bay.
So in November of 2007, a ship bumped into the Bay Bridge, and it spilled a lot of bunker fuel, which is sort of the dregs of fuel. So this was about 58,000 gallons. And the reason that a lot of people come to San Francisco in early November is because there's a green festival. And one of the people that was at the green festival was Paul Stamets. And he and I had been talking for years about our two programs. He worked with mushrooms and remediation, and our charity worked with using hair and fur and fleece to soak up oil. Because the reason you shampoo is because hair is really efficient at soaking up oil. So we went out to the beach as this oil started to come in, and we bumped into a bunch of surfers that were out there, and there was nobody helping clean up this one large open access beach. And we said, you know what, we have a lot of hair mats. The surfers said, well, you know, we're going to do a blast on the internet and just see how many people we can get to come out. And we said we would too. And that first day we had about 80 people just that afternoon come out and take hair and start to soak up the oil. The next day it was pouring down with rain and we had about 250 people show up. And the next day we had about 500 people show up. And then the EPA and Red Cross stepped in and said, okay, we're going to start setting up volunteer training programs, because we started to have 800 people a time showing up to these training programs and lines around the block. And it just became this really, really big deal. And Paul said, you know what, let's try to remediate this. This is like a perfect scenario. And people from everywhere started to come around and really want to be involved in looking at seeing if fungi could break down the hydrocarbons in the oil.
For 2 years, Matter of Trust worked to remediate the oil-soaked hair mats. They didn't just use oyster mushrooms either. They used thermophilic fungi that thrive at high temperatures to compost, oil-digesting bacteria, and vermiculture, which employs worms to speed the composting process. The work was arduous, but Lisa told me she felt it was well worth the effort to take the spill on as a community. When I asked her to talk about what they observed using natural techniques to remediate the oil-soaked hair mats, this is what Lisa told me.
One thing I learned about this is that it all comes down to the smallest common denominator, and that was really the bacteria. It was the bacteria in the decomposing mushrooms. It was the bacteria in the tummies of the worms. It was the bacteria in the compost. And the worms were, you know, aerating by making little holes, and mushrooms would attract things and could break down to certain levels. And you know, you had aerobic and anaerobic things going on everywhere. And it was like watching Fantasia. It's a fascinating project. I think that students everywhere should try to do these experiments and figure out, you know, what's next, what works, what doesn't to your environment. It's nature's tools, really, really basic, extremely easy for even kids to understand. I think it's where we're seeing students look at next.
So mushrooms are great, right? Shouldn't everyone be crazy about mushrooms?
I didn't tell you that once you've eaten it, you become a mushroom too. And once you start, you can't stop.
Mushrooms don't always enjoy the best reputation. In the scariest moment of my favorite horror film, Matango, a group of snobby sophisticates crash their yacht into a remote island. Starving and desperate, they resort to eating atomic bomb-radiated, mind-controlling mushrooms. Eventually, all the castaways turn into overgrown fungus zombies and tear each other apart. It's sort of like Godzilla meets Gilligan's Island, and it chills me to the bone. Even today in the United States, many people are loath to trust mushrooms, assuming that they're either poisonous or unpalatable. You might even say we're a mycophobic culture. Unlike many Americans, however, Europeans and Asians covet mushrooms for their taste and variety, and mushrooming is an important part of the cultural heritage. And when they immigrate to the United States, they bring this love with them. Two of the people I met during my trip were Sam and Kay Longmire. Kay, who is of German descent, raised her son Sam in southern Indiana, and they both take great pride in their ability to find the elusive morel, a mushroom that sports a honeycomb cap that is devilishly difficult to find. Sam and Kay met me for tea and talked about how mushrooming has always been a part of their family's tradition.
When we would go hunting for mushrooms, we would often enter a woods marked no trespassing and very strongly and clearly marked so. And my father, who was extremely law-abiding in every aspect of his life, made one exception, and that was we would just climb a fence and walk in, and we would say, "Dad, it says no trespassing." And he would say, "But it's okay. We can come in as long as we're quiet. Nobody cares if we hunt mushroom in their woods. And besides that, all these mushrooms are just going to go to waste if we don't find them." It was a completely a part of our life, because from the time Sammy was first born, we were taking him in the woods because we just love walking in the woods. So he was in a backpack, and probably his first morel experience was when he was about 8 months, 6 to 8 months old, and we hunted the mushrooms around him and then would bring them to him and let him smell them and see them, hoping it would seep into his psyche, and I think it did, because he's way outstripped me now in mushroom knowledge.
Well, one of my earliest memories, perhaps my earliest, was mushroom hunting, morel hunting with my mother in Indiana. And As I recall, I could barely stand. I was a toddler. And they probably put me down in a patch. But I was very proud of myself finding lots of morel mushrooms. And I remember how good they tasted that night, fried in butter with cracker crumbs. Delicious.
I guess one of the reasons some people aren't excited about mushrooms is because the only mushrooms they know are the ones sold in grocery stores. And most people never take the chance to try the more interesting, adventurous mushrooms, like the fruity chanterelle or the stately reddish-brown porcini. This is changing, though. Dustin Olson, a mushroom farmer from Oregon, explained to me how he wins skeptics over.
At the farmer's market, I always get a kick out of the people who walk by and proclaim that they do not like mushrooms. And I immediately say, well, that's kind of like saying that you just don't like vegetables, because there's so many different mushrooms with so many different flavors. And so then I go on to tell them about something like candy caps, which tastes like maple syrup, and how you can dry them and put them in cookies and ice cream. And after that conversation gets rolling, they quickly realize that if your whole definition of a mushroom is the white button mushroom that you buy at the store, perhaps I can understand why you don't like mushrooms.
Besides Dustin, there are a lot of people trying to spread the word about how wonderful fungi are and teaching people not to be afraid of them. On a sunny fall morning, I returned to my hometown of Nevada City, California, located in the foothills of the Sierras, east of Sacramento. I had made arrangements to go on a field trip with mycologist Daniel Nicholson and a group of students and parents from Twin Ridges School.
Mushrooms come in a lot of different forms. I can't wait to show you all of these. We'll talk about how they grow and what they use for food, what they do use for food. Since they can't make their own food, they have to get their food from somewhere. So I want to pass around this one first because this one is just so pretty. This is called the blue-green anise mushroom. Yeah, what do you guys think? Does this one smell delicious? You guys all smelt it?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, pretty yummy, huh? So I think I've been experimenting with it. I want to put it in cookies sometime because this one is edible. This is kind of a special one. It grows only up here in the mountains. So that makes our little spot, our little watershed here, very special. Well, let's see what we can find on this little trail on Rock Creek.
Cool, we got practice to dig through the truffles.
Oh, here's some really cool dead man's fingers. Check this stuff out, you guys. So dead man fingers like to grow on wood, as you can see. I'm going to flick this and watch the spores come off.
Oh, wow.
Cool, huh? There's all the spores going off. So what do we got here? Ooh, now this is one of the mushrooms that could kill you.
Okay.
Oh.
This is Gallerina autumnalis. They call it the deadly Gallerina. It always grows on wood. It has a little bit of a brown spore print. Oh, cool. That's really cool, dude. What the heck is that?
Look at that.
Okay, now you're blowing my mind. What do you got? I'm going to have to cut this open.
Daniel knelt in the duff and sliced open the mushroom. As soon as he did, the pale flesh of the stalk and the lemon-yellow, spongy layer under the sticky cap turned a brilliant indigo blue.
Now there we go. There is that oxidization I was telling you about. It takes just a minute, but in just 1 second, it turns from yellow to blue. That's oxidization. And so
you can see it turning.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh? This is a slippery jack, a sawillus. It is edible. It's actually decent. It's a good food source. If we were in survival mode, we might be eating a little bit more of these. So these guys grow with trees, and I didn't tell you what they do. It's a very amazing, amazing thing that's happening. They are picking up the dead material and digesting it and sharing it with the trees. And the trees are making food and giving it to the mushroom. They're sharing food, water, and nutrients. Without this cycling of the nutrients that are in the forest and are in the ground, there's no way that the forest would grow so healthy.
You've been listening to part one of Crazy About Mushrooms. Join us next week on the bridge as Anna McHugh continues with more interviews and field recordings featuring some of the brightest minds in American mycology. Thank you for listening to today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.